This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we explore what Malaysia could look like with specific progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and previously on the show, we asked the question, what if Malaysia has less restrictions on freedom of speech akin to a country like the US? Today, we'll be exploring what if Malaysia legalizes abortion on demand. But as always, I can't do this alone. So joining me on the show today is Petra Gimbat, the Secretary of the Reproductive Rights Advocacy Alliance Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Petra. How are you doing?
Hi, great.
Perhaps you can start by giving me an overview of what the abortion laws are like in Malaysia currently.
Well, under the penal code, it's definitely a crime to cause harm to an unborn fetus. But what a lot of people don't know is that under the Medical Act, there's an exemption granted to doctors whereby if a doctor assesses that it's necessary to carry out an abortion in order to preserve a woman's physical or mental health, then in the eyes of the law, this is perfectly legal. And what is also interesting, because this came up with a client we had recently on the hotline, was that for Muslims under Sharia law, while it's not necessarily encouraged, it's only haram from the 120th day onwards. And even then, there are still certain caveats, you know, which may provide exceptions to the rule.
So does that mean that abortion is technically illegal, but there are some clauses rather than it is legal with restrictions?
I think something that a lot of us don't have maybe the time or the exposure to realize is that laws are not made in isolation. So, I mean, there's a context, you know, like to why, you know, like certain laws were put into place. So I'm not sure why it is that the penal code worded its clauses the way it is. But I think most of us can agree that, right, if you see a pregnant woman walking down the road, you know, the last thing you should do is to kick her, right? You know, because the last thing you want to do is to cause harm to her and the baby. But in the 1980s, what Malaysia was facing was a significant amount of maternal mortality. It was highly unlikely that both mother and fetus would be likely to survive childbirth. And doctors were put in a very difficult situation whereby they were having to choose whether they wanted to terminate such pregnancies in order to save the mother's life, knowing very well that it was very likely that if they didn't, both baby and mother would be unlikely to survive. But at the same time as well, because they were concerned as to what would happen to them under the law, eventually there were certain people in the various ministries, you know, who understood, you know, what the reality was and what the situation was. And that's where the exemption, you know, like came about specifically for doctors.
So does the legality of the abortion in Malaysia also encompass medical abortion pills like Mifepristone and also Misoprostol?
According to the law, this shouldn't be an issue for a female patient as long as a doctor first assesses her and decides that an abortion is absolutely necessary to preserve her physical or her mental health. The issue in Malaysia is that both of these medications are not licensed. I think it was one of the medications, the license was withdrawn in 2017. And this has put women and their partners in a very difficult position because for a lot of women who contact our organization or hotline, many of them also opt for abortion pills, even when we inform them what is the situation, you know, like of the law, right? And many of them, you know, are then, you know, like put into a position where they are forced to procure these pills online. So what we have observed is that the lack of licensing has led to a significant amount of uncertainty for women because they are unable to verify ahead of time whether these medications indeed are safe and whether they indeed are effective. So while many of the suppliers do provide valid and effective abortion pills, We also know from experiences and feedback that many of the women afterwards, you know, who contact us, you know, and tell us what happened, that unfortunately, like many of them, you know, bought fake pills, you know, which were unfortunately ineffective. And to give it a little bit of context, I mean, on average, maybe, you know, your abortion pills, you know, might cost maybe a few hundred ringgit. It could be from, say, like 300, 400, you know, to maybe like twice that amount, you know, three times that amount, depending on which supplier it is, you know, that you go to. So if you were a woman experiencing, say, you know, like a job loss, okay, in the middle of the COVID pandemic, and you decide that, right, you know, I can't keep this pregnancy regardless of whether it was planned or not. And by the way, 50% of pregnancies are unplanned. So that's a statistic for you. You know, like one in two of us were probably not exactly planned, okay?
Right.
So, you know, it puts women, you know, in a difficult position whereby, say, if you lost your job, it's pandemic time, you're having to scrounge, you know, like together a few hundred ringgit just to buy, you know, some abortion pills because maybe you're responsible not only for your spouse, but also for any kids you might already have. Maybe there are some parents or in-laws who are living with you, you know, in the house, right? Mm-hmm. And then you find out that you're still pregnant. I feel that there's a gross injustice being committed over here because either way, whether the woman decides to terminate the pregnancy or continue the pregnancy, the burden is on her, you know, and her body.
Definitely. But what about private clinics and hospitals, Petra? Because we discussed the legality aspect of it just a little while ago. But at the same time, it's not uncommon for me to hear people talk about how they would go to a private hospital to get an abortion, not because the mom's life is in danger or anything like that, but because for the reason of family planning. So why does there seem to be some kind of contradiction where you can get an abortion, but at the same time, it's not legal?
I think what we need to establish here is that abortions are legal as long as there's a medical doctor involved. And this is regardless of whether it's being carried out in a government hospital or a private hospital. There's this perception that, especially if you are single and unmarried, that if you were to go to a government clinic or a government hospital, they would give you a hard time. You know, like if, say, you know, you wanted to go on the pill and then you're unmarried, you know, they might give you a hard time because why are you having sex before marriage? So probably what you are talking about deals with the kind of stigma we are already experiencing in Malaysia, because most of us actually find it really difficult to talk about sex. And that has, I think, maybe impacted also, you know, the way in which medicine is being practice, because doctors and nurses and hospitals don't just pop out of anywhere.
Okay, so if abortion is legal, as long as a doctor, a licensed practitioner is involved, like, so how willing are the practitioners usually when it comes to decisions of proceeding with an abortion procedure on a request basis here in Malaysia? That means we know for a fact that if a mom's life is in danger, of course the doctor will do everything in his or her power to save the mother. But we are talking about situations where a 21-year-old who's unmarried and she gets pregnant and she's like, no, I don't think I'm ready to have this kid. I want to have an abortion. How willing are practitioners usually when it comes to these decisions?
So I think that there's a preconceived notion that it's easier to obtain an abortion in these kind of circumstances from a private clinic or a private doctor. And this is probably true because from what we understand, you know, from colleagues who are working in local government hospitals, you know, is that they have a practice, I think, you know, of requiring at least two doctors to meet and assess the woman patient in question, you know, to decide whether an abortion is indeed necessary. And this is very similar to what you see happening, you know, in the UK, you know, for the longest time. So it's not a legal requirement, but it's something that is done as a matter of practice. And from what we understand, this is being done in government hospitals here. As for private clinics and private hospitals, from what we know, it's not actually an issue or a problem to obtain abortions. But I think what is also important for us to remember is that, like, I'm really uncomfortable with this tendency that a lot of us have to splice into and differentiate this is what happens in a private hospital and this is what happens in a public hospital, because the private sector is so big. And surely you are going to get variations in opinions, you know, even among doctors, because right. we do hear of accounts, you know, whereby private doctors are also very uncomfortable with providing abortions. And they will turn away these patients without even a referral. Whereas, you know, in the government sector, no matter what the restrictions may be, you may also find, you know, like doctors who, regardless of whatever their hospital practices are actually very empathetic and very sympathetic to the plight that women experience.
Yes, but I guess one thing that I'm still trying to wrap my head around is, if abortion is legal in Malaysia, as long as a doctor is involved, how does it differ from countries like Canada?
So, I mean, what abortion, you know, on demand means, I mean, there are a few factors, right? But a couple of them, you know, would be there shouldn't be a waiting period. And that's really significant, because when you are looking at, say, how certain government hospitals provide or maybe assess female patients, you know, to see whether they are candidates, you know, for abortion, there's usually a referral process, you know, involved here. And anyone who's ever tried to get referred to a specialist, so say I tell you that, oh, I need to terminate this pregnancy because I am suicidal, let's say, or I need to terminate this pregnancy because I have a heart problem. Anyone who has tried to make an appointment with a specialist would know that there's a waiting period. And if you have money, it's quite possible that you could locate another hospital quite quickly to see a specialist, you know, as soon as possible. But if you don't have the money, what then happens is that you end up having to join a very long queue in the government sector. And this is definitely an issue of concern, because pregnancies are time constrained, right? And then the further along, you know, you wait, you know, it could be an uncomfortable process, you know, for the patient involved and whoever is supporting her, you know, involved. And also, I think that given that we have a shortage of specialists, and in a lot of areas we have a shortage of medical doctors, it also places a burden on our public healthcare system. Because if our law already states that only one doctor, you know, is necessary, then why are we placing this caveat here? And to some of us, it sounds as if though this is basically just a delaying tactic to discourage women from obtaining abortions. And from what we've observed, you know, from phone calls, you know, we get, you know, from women, you know, who encounter these kind of situations, is that it doesn't actually deter them. You know, I mean, we have women, you know, who contact us after 22 weeks of pregnancy, which is definitely, you know, like beyond what is legally allowed, you know, in Malaysia. Right. You know, like we have a limit as to when you can perform an abortion. You know, it's 22 weeks.
Okay.
And you know, like, and even when, you know, we explain to them, you know, that they'll just have to continue with the pregnancy, you know, unfortunately, and we are willing to refer them, you know, and try to get them, you know, like support. Women who are desperate, whatever the risk, no matter, you know, how advanced, you know, like pregnancy, you know, like is, they will still try to go ahead, you know, and figure out a way, you know, like to make things happen. Like, I remember one of the hotline counselors, you know, like telling me one day, because she was very much affected, you know, by a client. She was telling this client that, look, you know, I mean, you're way past, you know, the first trimester, so you can't take abortion pills. If you really want to still carry out, you know, an abortion, then what you need to do, you know, is to go for a surgical abortion. And this client told her that, look, you know, like I can't afford, you know, a surgical abortion, and I can only afford abortion pills. And she took pictures of her stomach, and she said, like, look, you know, so she sent these pictures over, you know, to one of the hotline paracounselors and said, look at my stomach, it's absolutely flat. You can't tell me, you know, that the abortion pills, you know, don't work. So these are the kind of desperate situations that our hotline advisors have to deal with.
And you mentioned the waiting list, right? Do you get placed on, like, do you get pushed up or down the waiting list depending on the reason you want to get an abortion?
So you've hit, you know, the nail on the head, because it doesn't even have to apply to a 21-year-old girl, right? Yeah. It can equally apply to a 41-year-old woman with two or three kids.
Yeah, who's already married and all that. Yeah,
and again, I think this is where the Hippocratic Oath, you know, is so, you know, like, important. Doctors take an oath not to cause harm, and I believe that many of them enter this profession for the best of intentions. But none of us grew up on an island or an alien planet, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're all subject, you know, like, to certain ideas, you know, and certain stereotypes and certain biases in society. I think, like, the difficulty here is exactly that, you know, like, unless if you can show that, right, if I continue, you know, with this pregnancy, you know, I might die, you might just be placed into the queue like everyone else. And if, you know, your specialist happens to be more busy, you know, than average, then this might delay any kind of closure for anything between a few weeks, you know, to longer, you know, it might be a couple of months.
In Malaysia, there is no abortion on demand right now. What are the consequences of having these type of restrictions when it comes to abortion?
One of the things that make up, you know, what abortion on demand, you know, means is, in addition to not having long and unreasonable waiting times, the other definition of abortion on demand is that you shouldn't have to cross states or cross districts in order to access a termination. And what we've observed from the hotline, because of stigma or lack of knowledge, you know, or just a lack of not only government doctors, but also private doctors available in the state to provide abortions. Women are crossing states, you know, and they are basically, you know, like, placing themselves, you know, in difficult, you know, like, situations, just so that, you know, they can eventually get to a doctor who's willing to perform the termination.
What about baby dumping? We know that baby dumping is a huge social concern in Malaysia. And according to the Malaysia's former Women, Family and Community Development Minister, Dato' Sri Dr. Wan Azizah, more than 1,000 cases of baby dumping have been recorded between 2010 and 2019. Do you think there is a connection between these cases of baby dumping and the state, a legal state of abortion in the country?
All right. So I think that what a lot of people are afraid of is, if we were to present abortion as the solution for baby dumping, then this would mean that all girls who might have otherwise kept their pregnancies would automatically terminate their pregnancies. And I think that's not true. I think that the fact that baby dumping happens in Malaysia, and the fact that abortion is also so stigmatized at the same time, reflects a bigger problem. And that is of the lack of comprehensive sexuality education. If we are talking about coming up with a national strategy to resolve the issue of baby dumping, it has to be wide scale and holistic, whereby on the one hand, women and their partners are able to access not only termination services, but also contraception, sexually transmitted infections, tests, you know, and treatment, you know, as well. So that's on the one hand. But at the same time, what we also need to see, you know, is the introduction of a good and solid comprehensive sexuality education curriculum in schools, so that children and teenagers are thinking about issues of respect and consent, which I personally feel, you know, actually comes, you know, like, before even, you know, any discussion of menstruation, of sexual activity or contraception, because you can know how all of these work and have sex when, say, you know, like, you're 30 years old and still find yourself in an absolutely problematic relationship. So I feel that, you know, when we talk about sex education, it's not just in schools anymore, but it's also about having public conversations such as what you and I are having, so that, you know, like, adults are also thinking about their own behaviors, you know, and being more aware of, well, you know, what does a respectful relationship look like? And then from there, looking at the data and science and healthcare services, you know, like, to decide what are my best options, or how can I support my partner if it's my partner who's having to, let's say, go on the pill? Yeah. Like, how do I make this more comfortable and more pleasant for her?
Well, on that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. After the break, we'll be exploring if legalizing abortion on demand could be a solution to some of the problems we've discussed before. We'll be back with more on What If Malaysia, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we examine what Malaysia could look like with certain progressive ideas, concepts and policies. I'm Darshan Johan, and with me on the show today is Petra Gimba, the Secretary of the Reproductive Rights Advocacy Alliance Malaysia. On today's episode, we are exploring what if Malaysia legalizes abortion on demand. Petra, there's always been polarizing debate between those who are pro-life and those who are pro-choice when it comes to the decriminalization and legalization of abortion. Can you briefly outline and explain the opposing takes on the issue, and perhaps even what are some of the common misconceptions attached to both these stances?
Right. So this is really interesting, because when you gave me this question to ponder on before our interview, I shared it with my colleagues, and I think it made them miserable, you know, like knowing that the way we talk about abortion is, like you said, just so polarized. Mm-hmm. So I think the assumption, and this is a very broad assumption, right, is that if you're a pro-lifer, then what you value is the life of the baby first and foremost, above all else. And this is the reason why you're anti-abortion. And if you're a pro-choicer, you know, then I think the stereotype, you know, is that, you know, like pro-choicers are all for abortions and maybe not for continuing pregnancies, you know, or not for, say, you know, like supporting adoption, you know, as a choice. And I'm uncomfortable with both stereotypes, because as a pro-choicer, in my case, I believe that women and their partners should be provided choices that are informed and should be supported in those choices, whatever they choose. And this is partly based on what our lived realities are, and it's partly also based on data and science. So just now, you know, I talked about how we sometimes get hotline callers, you know, saying that I'm past 22 weeks of pregnancy, but I still want to get a termination anyway. And unfortunately, I mean, like, based on what we know, even though we are all, you know, like, for choice, those choices are also influenced by the laws, you know, and what is safe, you know, and what is available, right? So that's from me, you know, as a pro-choicer.
Right.
But, you know, when you're talking about pro-lifers, and again, this is why I'm uncomfortable with these stereotypes. I also know of pro-lifers who, when you really drill down to, well, but are there really any circumstances whereby you would object, you know, to abortion? You might still find a few, you know, who might say that, well, I can at the very least totally understand if a couple may want to terminate a pregnancy if they discover that a fetus is likely to be born disabled, right? You know, because we don't want to bring a child into this world, you know, who's just going to suffer and who's going to take care, you know, of this child, you know, like after we are gone. You might also find pro-lifers who say, well, you know, I'm against abortions, but if it's a case of rape, if it's a case of incest, you know, if it's to save, you know, the mother's life, I can then understand why, you know, in these kind of situations, you know, an abortion might be necessary. So I think it's more important to locate what the two have in common rather than to focus on what drives the two apart. I have worked with people, you know, who are not comfortable with the idea of abortion, but who are absolutely willing, you know, to assist in providing financial aid, let's say, you know, like for childbirth. We are also involved in this, by the way. We've also, like, worked with people, you know, who are willing to provide girls who are pregnant a place to stay, you know, like until, you know, they deliver. So again, you know, like I think when we look at the words life, you know, and choice, we need to ask ourselves, well, what does life actually mean? And I think life is not just about the life of the child, but it also, you know, extends, you know, to a woman's life. It may extend to a family's life. It may extend to other people, you know, like this woman, you know, like needs to actually, like, care for.
Let's talk about Canada for a second, right? Because Canada is one of the countries with the most liberal abortion laws in the world, where abortion is legal at all stages of pregnancy and is even publicly funded as a medical procedure under the health policy. However, their take on the abortion law had been rather conservative throughout the 19th and early 20th century. It wasn't, until 1988 that the Supreme Court finally ruled that the previous existing law violated the principles of fundamental justice, which is a person's right to life, liberty, and security. And this has remained legal since then. And the access to abortion services has also been made widely available across the country, right? Can you explain how Canada has benefited from this move? Have they even benefited from this move to begin with?
When you reduce barriers for women and couples seeking terminations, you reduce the amount of mental distress they are having to face, you know, in these kind of like situations. So one of the conditions, you know, of abortion on demand is that a woman shouldn't have to prove special circumstances, you know, in order to obtain, you know, an abortion. And when I read that, you know, that this is one of the things, you know, that this is one of the definitions of abortion on demand. This really struck home for me because I work from time to time with rape and sexual abuse survivors. And many of them, I mean, most of them often decide that they're not going to make a police report. So let's say, you know, you have a patient who wishes to have an abortion because she was raped. But for many reasons, and this really is the case, you know, with most cases, you know, when you're talking about sexual abuse, whether it's men who are sexually abused or women who are sexually abused, most of us will not report. What are you going to do? Are you then going to demand that, right, I want you to go to a police station now, tell a few policemen and a few policewomen your sordid story, get that police report, you know, like done first, prove that, you know, it happened, you know, like go through court, and then only, you know, we'll talk, you know, about, you know, like granting you an abortion. So there are so many reasons, you know, like why, you know, like women may seek abortions. And I think where Canada, you know, has benefited. So in addition to setting up an environment that's much more conducive, you know, for patients, you know, and for couples, I think it's a reflection of how mature maybe, you know, like Canada is when it comes to approaching issues of abortion and sexual health and sex education and contraception in a far more mature manner that benefits, you know, like society. Because again and again, like the reason why I like working, you know, with reproductive health, and I've been meditating a lot, you know, on this term, you know, reproductive, you know, like justice recently, you know, is that you really see, you know, through the hotline how there's a demarcation between the haves and the haves not. So if you're in a position of privilege, chances are it wouldn't be an issue for you to obtain an abortion. You go to a hospital, the doctor doesn't want to do it, you could probably go to another hospital, you know, like anyway, you know, and get it done. But if you're a woman in a difficult financial position, and that has been definitely compounded by the pandemic because we are seeing an increase in these kind of like callers, it's so easy for us as society, you know, to point the finger and say, oh, you know, like this woman, you know, is a baby killer. But what are we doing ourselves to make society much more equitable for everyone? You know, and I think that if we say that we care about justice, we care about equality, we care about life, you know, then, you know, we have to ask ourselves, you know, then what are we doing in service in humanity to make life better for everyone? And that is the thing that disturbs me whenever we get into, you know, like these kind of discussions, you know, about abortion, you know, because they tend to be very black and white. And there's a lack of tendency, unfortunately, to talk about the bigger picture. When you have a state that understands that reproductive rights is also about providing reproductive justice, you know, and societal, you know, equality, then you don't just think about providing abortions on demand as an endpoint. You're thinking about coming up, you know, with policies, you know, that deal with sexual health and reproductive health, you know, at all aspects. So something that alarms me a lot, because I used to be a school teacher and I used to teach at university, you know, is that there's such a lack of conversation and inability, you know, of adults to talk to teenagers about what safer sex, you know, could look like. And I mean, when I used to substitute in a government school, you see this strong pattern whereby parents don't want to talk about it, and they hope and pray that teachers in school will somehow lecture their kids, you know, and discourage them from having premarital sex. But they are not going to talk about it. And then on the other hand, you know, you have the teachers, you know, who vocalize out loud, this is not my responsibility. You know, if their if these kids' parents won't even talk to them, you know, about these things, you know, then it's not up to me. You know, like, it's not my responsibility. You know, in Malaysia, we are not used to talking about sex in a mature way. You know, I mean, we do the dirty jokes, you know, we forward, you know, all sorts of stupid jokes over, you know, like WhatsApp. So, you know, we can joke about things, you know, but so many of us can't even say the word penis, you know, in public. We can't even say vagina. We can't even, you know, like talk about how when you are sexually active, you need to talk about condom use first. You know, you need to talk about, you know, like contraceptive use before you even start engaging, you know, in sexual relations.
And how do you think that legalizing abortion on demand or abortion by request, do you think this would help us overcome the social stigmas attached to abortion, or at least one of the ways we can overcome these social stigmas?
I think providing abortion on demand in the short term will not reduce stigma, because again, you know, you have a lot of stereotypes regarding abortion on demand. I mean, again, you know, like you gave the comparison between assumptions, you know, of people, you know, who believe that abortion on demand will mean that no one uses condoms. And it's really problematic when this comes from pro-lifers, because I don't think they realize that this makes them look so bad. You know, that you automatically will stop using condoms and you just rely on abortion as a method of contraception. And this is with inverted commas, because abortion is not contraception. And any doctor who, and any good doctor, you know, like who is worth his salt, you know, really should be talking to patients who come in obtaining terminations to encourage them, you know, like to go on, to go, you know, on contraception. So I think in the short term, it's not going to reduce stigma. But I think in the long term, after everyone has had time, you know, to keep calm and chill out, we'll be able, you know, to see that, again, abortion on demand isn't going to take away the fact that couples, many couples actually still will have to make difficult decisions when they encounter unplanned pregnancies. The available of something that we think is easier, because it's not going to be easy, right? You know, mm-hmm. It's just easier, doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is going to rush for the hills, you know, and like go for and have an abortion. I think, you know, like for even for people who fear that possibility, it's not so clear cut that this is going to actually, you know, like happen. So in the short term, I think there won't be a lessening of stigma, but I think in the long term, there will be enough cases, you know, like to show that not every woman or every couple who finds herself facing an unplanned pregnancy is going to opt for an abortion. You know, like many of them will probably still carry to full term, or many of them might still opt for adoption, because, you know, we can't forget that religion is a big thing, you know, in Malaysia, right? So you can provide abortion on demand, but, you know, you also have a lot of couples, you know, who decide that I'm not comfortable with this option. So as long as I feel I have the financial and physical capacity to continue with this, and for some of us, you know, if we are lucky enough to be surrounded by friends and families, you know, who are able to help us raise our children, we might still, you know, end up, you know, like seeing couples, you know, who carry through, you know, the abortion. What I am hopeful for, you know, is if we ever get to a point where we are actually considering abortion on demand, I would hope that this also means Malaysian society has gotten to a point where we can talk about consent, talk about respect, talk about contraception, talk about sexually, you know, like transmitted disease, talk about all these things that reduce the occurrences of unplanned pregnancies and ultimately unwanted pregnancies, so that women and couples and doctors would not have to even deal with the numbers we already do dealing with abortions in the first place.
Now let's imagine Malaysia actually legalized abortion on demand. How do you think this will transform our country?
I think providing abortion on demand would probably make life a lot easier for pregnant women who make that decision, couples who make that decision, and medical healthcare, you know, like workers, you know, who would hopefully then, you know, feel a lot more comfortable, you know, under the law, you know, like to provide this procedure, you know, like to patients. But again, I mean, if we were to implement this, I mean, going back to the example that you gave, you know, of Canada, right? I would hope, because this has been the case, you know, like of Canada, it wasn't like, I don't think it's so clear cut to say, oh, Canada woke up one day and decided, right, we need a portion of demand.
Definitely.
I think, you know, like it was actually part, you know, of a bigger approach, you know, whereby it's like, look, we need to make sure that everyone is taking care of their sexual health. Everyone is taking care of their reproductive health. So these are the many things, you know, we are going to put into place. And by the way, I mean, reproductive health also, you know, includes prenatal care, you know, and postnatal care, right, you know, and childbirth. So, you know, we are going to make sure that our services are comprehensive and accessible, and abortion just happens to be one of those services. But yeah, and in addition to that, you know, we need to be having, again, public conversation so that people understand what are their options, what the realities are, hopefully through the kind of conversations that you have, you know, like with your guests, right? people get used to just listening to each other talk about issues that we still tend to think are quite taboo, and get used, you know, to using the kind of language and the kind of conversations, you know, we are having, you know, so that they can apply them to their own realities. So that is what I hope. Like, if Malaysia ever legalizes, you know, abortion on demand, you know, that it will be reflective of a better reality that not only puts the life of any born children first, but also, you know, it thinks about what gender equality and economic justice looks like for women and couples and families.
So I guess the big question before we wrap up is Malaysia ready for it?
To be honest, I don't know whether any country is ready for it. So if you're talking about abortion on demand, you know, like specifically,
right.
I definitely think on a practical level, it will just cut down on so much distress, and it will just cut down on so much work, you know, for a very overburdened, you know, like healthcare force. But I think what Malaysia definitely needs is this bigger approach we've seen from some of the examples, you know, we've discussed, you know, countries who implement, you know, abortion on demand, whereby, like, for example, you know, like we have affordable contraception, you know, available. How do we make sure, you know, that healthcare workers are comfortable talking about contraception, right? You know, rather than shying away. How do we, I mean, when you look at sexually transmitted infections tests, you know, they're about like, what, 200 ringgit, you know, and up. You know, how do we make this, you know, more affordable? You know, I mean, because again, I don't think abortion on demand should be taken in isolation. It's actually just one, how do we say this, symptom, you know, of like a bigger approach. Mm-hmm. And also, hopefully, if we do see abortion in demand, you know, in Malaysia, this is just one of the things, you know, that also come about because we finally decided, you know, to implement a comprehensive sexuality education curriculum in schools whereby school children and teenagers are able to talk about consent and respect, and also public education of adults, you know, in newspapers, you know, and television, you know, and radio.
All right. On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Petra.
Okay. Thank you. It was good talking to you.
That was Petra Gimbert, the Secretary of the Reproductive Rights Advocacy Alliance Malaysia, answering the question, what if Malaysia legalizes abortion on demand? And that wraps up the fourth episode of What If Malaysia, an 8-episode miniseries where we explore what Malaysia could look like with specific progressive ideas, concepts and policies. So if you missed any part of this conversation or the first few episodes of the series, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or you can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. You just have to search BFM, live and learn. Once again, I'm Darshan Johan, and you've been listening to What If Malaysia on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.